I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order for the Oregon Legislature. It's Monday, May 7th, and we're all happy to be here. And today we have four bills up in front of us. I'm going to start out with Senate Bill 256, and then 440, then 118, and 122 last. So with that, I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 256. Steve, give us a little background on this Senate bill, please.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. Senate Bill 256 establishes requirements, unless parties agree otherwise, for motor vehicle liability arbitration proceedings.
And first up, I have Neil Jackson and Steve Morrell at the same time. Welcome, gentlemen. If you would please state your name for the record and give us your testimony to enlighten our knowledge of this bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. This bill, we essentially reached an agreement with the insurance companies on the changes that we want to make concerning the procedures for arbitration of disputes, both as to uninsured motorist claims and as to what are called PIP disputes, personal injury protection. Presently, there are different types of or different ways that arbitration are done now. We're trying to level the playing field for all insurance companies. In UM, that's uninsured motorist and underinsured motorist claims, those would be conducted with a panel of three arbitrators. PIP can be three or one, depending on what the policy provides. Another thing this bill does is it also creates a way for smaller claims that the consumer would be able to go ahead and proceed to arbitration and would not have to pay to have their doctor come in live. The doctor's testimony would be introduced via a report. If you have a smaller case and it's costing $3,000 to $5,000 to bring a doctor in, the consumer really isn't in a position to be able to do that. This would allow that the doctor could submit a report. They would still be subject to depositions being taken, but it would save a lot of money, particularly on the smaller cases. The final thing that this bill does is it overturns the Barackman decision. That was a decision handed about by our appellate courts, which the court said that the law as it is presently written, if a consumer has a dispute with their own carrier and they go arbitrate that dispute, and you need to understand these are very quick. The PIP arbitrations are very quick. They're not anything like a trial. You go up in front of generally one arbitrator, and you can put the whole case on in about an hour. Barackman said that in those situations, if the consumer, part of their bills, it was the decision of the single arbitrator that part of their bills were not tied to the accident, the consumer could then not go forward against the party at fault and try and recover those bills. The rationale in changing it is because they are very abbreviated hearings. This just shortens it up and allows the consumer to then go ahead and proceed and try and recover from the at-fault driver. It's a consumer-friendly bill, and we hope you'll support it.
Thank you.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Steve Merle for State Farm Insurance. I think Mr. Jackson's done a good job of hitting the highlights of the bill. One thing that, two things actually I'd like to point out is that, first of all, the parties are allowed in uninsured motorist arbitrations under this bill to agree to something less than three arbitrators. Kind of the discussion that we've had back and forth is that on small cases, a single arbitrator is probably appropriate for quality of decision and also for expense management. The thing that happens with three arbitrators, the insurance company ends up paying for all of them. We would pay for one, a single arbitrator if they chose one. The other thing that happens with a single arbitrator is that you probably get a more expeditious hearing because you're trying at that time to only coordinate the calendars of the two lawyers who are trying the case and the arbitrator versus five lawyers when you have a panel of three. We're kind of stepping our toe in the water here to kind of see how this works out and see if people make the kind of decisions that would be good rational choices as far as one versus three. And to that end, this bill contains a sunset provision for Section 2 of the bill that would operate to close it down. And if we feel like this has been an area where it hasn't worked well, we'll be making that argument somewhere in the future. With that, I'm available to answer any questions the committee might have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Gerard.
Thank you. So, simply put, this is just a simplification of the arbitration laws as far as the arbitration hearings. It looks to me like a good thing, but it's more of a simplification then.
Shareholder Representative Gerard, that's correct. It's, I think most people want three arbitrators. There were some companies going to single arbitrators, and this just kind of says, hey, we're going to come back the way everybody always viewed it in the past. Sure.
Further questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if you could please, either of you, run the Berrickman decision section by me again. I'm not sure I grasped what that reason is.
Go ahead.
Shareholder Representative Bonamici, what Berrickman did was it said that in a case where you're disputing PIP benefits, in other words, I have an accident and my carrier is obligated to pay my medical bills under PIP. That's a first-party relationship with my carrier. And if I don't feel like they've paid as much as they should have, or they didn't pay for some services I felt were related to the accident that they said weren't, currently you can arbitrate that dispute. What happened with Berrickman was is that, well, I am arbitrating that dispute, and maybe somebody else over here is responsible for the liability claim, that I have a damage claim, a tort claim against them. I arbitrate with my carrier, and the carrier wins. They prevail on the issues of the medical bills. The court said that is now collateral estoppel and binding on the tort litigation. And I understand why the court said that. Personally, looking at it as just a company philosophy thing, Mr. Jackson said, these hearings with PIP arbitrations are fairly simplified. And I don't know that the full and fair hearing prong that you normally have to satisfy under collateral estoppel, that most of us would feel like that had been satisfied. And so what we've done here is in Section 3 of the bill, we've said that they're not binding on anybody else and they can't be used for collateral estoppel, so that you're not under risk. If I have this dispute with my own carrier, I don't risk giving up my liability claim.
Thank you.
Further questions, Senator Nelson?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Jackson, Mr. Merrill, does this direct us, or does this specify that all claims like this will be handled through arbitration? Can I choose on my own?
Yes, you can. The parties can always agree otherwise, and that stays that way.
Okay, follow up, please.
Follow up.
And could you tell me, I'm always concerned about the privacy issue of people, and is this public information when you have an arbitration?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, no, these are private arbitrations.
Okay, they're so general. Nobody can pierce that veil of privacy.
Well, the only parties that would, I assume you're talking about medical records mainly. Yeah, the only parties that are really involved would be the consumer, their attorney, and the attorney for the insurance company, and of course the arbitrator who would make the decision. But they're not published, they're not put up in any courthouses, anything like that. It's basically a contractual arbitration between the consumer and their own insurance company.
If I could add to that. Shareholder Representative Nelson, insurance companies are covered by a federal law known as the Graham-Leach-Bliley law that caused a lot of privacy legislation then at the state level to at least provide that level of protection. Oregon in 2001 session put that into place for insurance companies. So we have a privacy law that we operate under, so the records the insurance company has are subject to that privacy law, and only the exceptions that the legislature has already set are appropriate.
Thank you. We did something great in 2001. I didn't even know it.
Further questions? Not seeing any further questions. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is anybody else signed up for this bill? Here or not. So with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 256A and open a work session on Senate Bill 256A.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I move Senate Bill 256A to the floor with a due-pass recommendation.
Senator Nelson moves Senate Bill 256A to the floor with a due-pass recommendation. Discussion?
You better say representative because there is a Senator Nelson.
Oh, representative. Did I call you Senator?
Yes, I bet there is
that's
one.
Twice.
So. Yeah, no, it's nice.
Well, there is a Senator. Emotion.
Yeah. Dave probably wouldn't appreciate it, but.
Oh, he would.
No discussion to that. Mr. Riley, would you please give us a roll call vote, please?
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative
Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative
Nelson?
Aye.
Chair Holby? Aye. Senate Bill 256A, having received the required majority votes, is declared passed. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 256, and would you like to carry it?
Aye.
Senator Nelson will carry that bill on the floor. Representative Nelson will carry that bill. Okay, with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 440A. I'll make you a senator before the end of the session.
Good.
Steve, would you give us a little explanation of Senate Bill 440, please?
Thank you, Chair Holby. Senate Bill 440A expands information to be included on manufactured structure ownership documents issued on or after the effective date of this act.
Thank you. And we have signed up Ron Northcraft and Diane Belt. Looks like they're sort of coming together. Welcome
Good
to
morning.
Salem.
Afternoon.
Thank you. Okay, I'll let Steve Dixon make an announcement to the committee here real briefly.
Just for the committee's information, there are dash A3 amendments to the Senate bill before.
With that, I will open it up for testimony. If you'd state your name for the record.
Sure, my name is Diane Belt, and I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I'm also the tax collection supervisor for Washington County. Senate Bill 440 is before you today, and I appreciate you hearing our bill to kind of correct and solidify an issue we had with what we call the LOA system. And let me give you just a quick little history about the LOA system. Prior to 2003, the Department of Motor Vehicles handled all the titling issues and ownership of manufactured homes, and it was decided at that time that was at the best use of our federal highway funds. So a work group convened, and in 2003 we came up with what we now call the LOA system. It was transferred to DCBS, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and the counties became an agent, and we handle all the transactions at our level. And LOIS is actually not an acronym for anything. It's named after a very, very good friend, Lois Colson, who was a part of that work group from the Department of Revenue. Unfortunately, she passed away from cancer before we got to see this implemented. We're beginning our third year, and we're working all of the bugs out, but this is one bug that we need to address. One of the intents of the original from the work group was to capture the supplemental information on a manufactured home, unlike a stick-built home where it's easy for the assessment folks to go in and find out how many bedrooms, what kind of siding, what kind of roof. We've never been able to capture that type of information on manufactured structures, nor have we been able to capture purchase price or anything like that to develop a really robust database that all stakeholders can use. And that's what we're asking for, is that in order to begin this database, we need to collect the information. We had thought that we could probably use the rulemaking process at the time, but after we've gotten into the system, we've decided it's best to spell it out in statute. What the Dash 3 amendment does, the Dash 2 amendments inadvertently omitted two kind of important portions. One, we had a typographical error. It referred to a statute that did not exist. And the second one was to define what current year tax means. And so we've actually defined that to and refers back to the statutes and tax collection that refers to what a current year tax is, because we do have to be sure if the a manufactured structure leaves our county prior to our tax roll that we collect those funds before it goes to the next county, because it's taxable where it's located at on January 1. So to alleviate any question about what current year meant, the amendment will address that issue.
Thank you. Would you like to provide us with some more testimony, sir?
Ron Northcraft, Douglas County Assessor, past president of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I'm here to lend support, answer any questions that may arise. The supplemental information that was referred to is important to the assessment world. The sale price, sale date, that information is critical to do a effective evaluation of the manufactured homes. We're here to add that information to the statute so that we can begin to obtain it, and continue with our assessment practice.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. I think that's nice of y'all to name that after Lois.
Yes.
Ms. Belton, Mr. Northcraft, is this same information required from other types of real property, other homes?
On real
property? I don't recall bathrooms and that sort of thing being required of me.
Representative Nelson, Chair. The building permit, when you obtain a building permit, you'll give all the specific information regarding the structure to the building department for each county. Every time a deed is recorded, Oregon is a full disclosure state. Sale price, sale date is there available.
Follow it. So, if you make a change in your house, like I knocked out two bedrooms to make a rec room, have I got to run down to your office and report this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I hope you got a building permit to do that.
Or I didn't.
Oh, well.
You're on TV.
That's okay.
Actually, anytime you do any kind of renovation to your property, you are required to go down to your planning or land use and transportation to obtain a building permit. Because that also affects the assessment of your property, as well as they're going to want to look at anything you might have done, electrical or plumbing. So you are required to get a building permit to do that.
So the same information that you're asking of the mobile homes owners is required of everybody?
That's correct.
Yes.
Oh, good. I'm going to jail.
Further questions from the committee? I noticed that in the dash 3 amendments there is a you're deleting a certain section, and could you go over that for me just real briefly about the homestead deferral? I'm not sure, did you mention that?
Oh.
Why the homestead deferral was mentioned in the original bill and it's being taken out?
I don't believe it's being taken out. It's just what they're doing on page 2, Mr. Chair, is I got the wrong glasses. They're just all it is we're not taking out what it's going to say is documentation satisfactory to the county assessor that all taxes, then delete the rest of that line and insert special assessments and other charges placed on the tax roll that have been certified for collection under ORS 311-105, and then in line 31, he just took out MENTS for the current year. He just took out the last part of that sentence, special assessments for the current year. But the homestead deferral is a senior deferral. Property owners who meet certain criteria, if you're over the age of 62 and you're within a certain income, or you're disabled and receiving SSI under limited income, you can apply to have your taxes deferred, which means that the state of Oregon pays those taxes, but at the time the property is sold or if the deferral is canceled, those taxes need to be paid. So what this is talking about is to be sure that those delinquent taxes on the homestead senior deferral are also taken care of at the time of a transfer.
Thank you. That clears it up for me, and I see that the homestead deferral actually isn't being taken out, so thank you.
And when you said that, I thought, oh, dear, not again.
Okay, great. Any other questions from the committee? Not seeing any. Thank you so much for coming up and explaining this bill to us.
Appreciate it.
No one else signed up on this bill, I believe. Nobody else wishing to testify to it? Oh, somebody's coming forward. Look.
Just very quickly, Don Miner, Manufactured Housing Association. We support the bill and the amendment. This information will help private sector appraisers also establish value for purposes of buyers securing loans. We've supported. It's a goal we've had for many years. Just working through the bugs in the LOA system. This is one that all persons, escrow companies, title companies, industry, government want to correct. And I think this does it.
Okay. Great. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Miner. He did state his name for the record.
He did.
Okay, great. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 440A and open a work session on Senate Bill 440A.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the -A3 amendments to Senate Bill 440.
Representative Bonamici moves that we adopt the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 440. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, they're so adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Gaveling. I have to wait for you to gavel.
No, go ahead.
I move Senate Bill 440 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 440A to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Mr. Riley, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Belizio?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative
Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative
Nelson?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 440A, having received the required majority vote, is declared passed. And do I have a carrier on the floor for this bill? Or could we go to the...
carrier if nobody wants it?
I was going to say, we haven't done any consent calendars.
I think it's nice if the manufactured homeowners want this. I think it ought to get a big ballyhoo in the session. I do.
Representative Nelson volunteers to carry Senate Bill 440. Two in a row.
All right. many days apart, I'm sure.
With that, I close the work session on 440 if I haven't done it already, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 118A. Steve, if you could give us a brief summary of Senate Bill 118, I would appreciate it.
Senate Bill 118A authorizes the governor to declare an abnormal disruption of the market under specified circumstances.
Thank you. And first up, we have Andrew Scholl from the Department of Justice. I hope I read your name correctly.
You did, Chair Holby. Thank you.
Which one is it?
Senate Bill 118. Go ahead and
Chair Holby,
state your name for the record, please, and give us your testimony.
Members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Andrew Scholl. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud, Consumer Protection Section. Senate Bill 118 was amended with consensus amendments by the Senate Commerce Committee to address several concerns voiced by various interested parties. The resulting Senate Bill 118A passed the Senate on March 29th with 21 ayes, 9 nays. No other interested parties have brought additional concerns to the attention of the Oregon Department of Justice. That's as of this morning. In the last decade, we've seen some pretty dramatic natural and man-made disasters. In the wake of these events, consumers have historically been deluged by many market scams. One of the most prevalent of these is price gouging. That is the profiteer-type price increases on necessary and essential consumer goods. Consumers are faced with the necessity of purchasing these goods and services for their health, safety, and welfare, sometimes at astronomical prices. though price increases may be necessary and understandable where a merchant or wholesaler has incurred higher expenses or costs, prices are sometimes increased despite no additional expenses or costs. For example, there were reports regarding individual motel and hotel owners who were allegedly raising their room rates and were believed to be doing so due to the large number of people arriving near the Fiscott wildfire several years ago. Motel and hotel rooms were arguably scarce at best, and therefore could be essential consumer goods and services, and they were not readily available. An example of this would be homeowners whose house was either under threat of the fire or destroyed by the fire looking for suitable lodging. In a similar situation, Senate Bill 118A would provide for the declaration of an abnormal disruption of the market in the affected geographical area only, should the governor determine that such has occurred and such is warranted. There would therefore subsequently provide protection under Senate Bill 118A for Oregon consumers, along with guidance to Oregon businesses operating within the affected area. More recently, following Hurricane Katrina in August of 2005, the federal government reported that complaints regarding gasoline price gouging exceeded thousands per day. And this was up from hundreds per day just prior to Hurricane Katrina. Here, gasoline became an essential consumer good not readily available due to disruptions in the petroleum industry along the Gulf Coast after Hurricane Katrina. In part due to Katrina, more and more states are pushing for adequate price gouging legislation. Approximately 30 states have or are actively pursuing price gouging laws. There's a breakdown of the 30 or so state laws and or proposals with your written testimony. Well, obviously, Oregon will most likely never experience a hurricane. Events such as the 2004 tsunami in Indonesia, recent localized volcanic and tectonic activity continue to remind Oregon of the possibility of widespread disaster. The general provisions of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act do provide a wide spectrum of protection against consumer fraud. However, the general provisions do not provide the specificity or the efficiency needed by the Attorney General for a rapid response against price gougers in a time of chaos or disaster. Nor does the UTPA currently provide any specific price gouging guidance to businesses wishing to do the right thing. In the event of a disaster, Senate Bill 118A provides the specific mechanism needed by the Attorney General for rapid response. In addition, it clearly defines parameters for Oregon businesses so they know the enforcement policies regarding price gouging. It's along similar lines that states like Mississippi, which had strong price gouging laws in effect in the wake of Katrina, were not only able to institute swift enforcement action against violators, but they were also able to provide clear guidance to businesses and warn them in advance of the price gouging laws and the ramifications for violating those laws. In other words, some of those states that were affected by Hurricane Katrina were able to use their price gouging laws as hammers in order to help prevent some price gouging before it happens. Senate Bill 118A makes it a specific violation of the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act for certain merchants and wholesalers to sell or offer to sell any essential consumer goods or services for an amount that is unconscionably excessive as defined by the proposal. And this is, again, only during a declared abnormal disruption and only in the area affected by that declaration that the governor has to make. Senate Bill 118A takes into account the situation where increased prices in excess of 15% are attributable to additional costs imposed upon businesses due to the event, or otherwise the result of just market factors, whether they're global market factors or national market factors. It also takes into consideration those price increases that are a result of an internal increased cost related to the actual declaration, so related to whatever the event was that caused the declaration. The law would only be triggered by the declared abnormal disruption of the market proclaimed by the governor. It is only applicable to essential consumer goods or services that are bought or rendered primarily for personal, family, or household purposes. Unless extended by subsequent declarations from the governor or unless terminated sooner by the governor or the legislative assembly, these declarations of abnormal disruptions of the market automatically terminate 30 days after the governor makes the declaration. Last, Senate Bill 118A incorporates the violation into Oregon Revised Statute 646-607, so there is no private right of action. This is a statute that would have enforcement authority by the Attorney General and by local district attorneys only. So with that, I thank you for your time, and of course, I'd be more than willing to attempt to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Girard.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I have a lot of problems with this bill, especially Section 3, Sub 1. Can you tell me what would constitute an abnormal disruption? I mean, we talked about natural, emergencies or a tsunami, but there's no description in here as to what really constitutes a disruption in the market. And that bothers me to give someone that much power concerning any natural, oil prices fluctuate greatly. I mean, is he going to come in if prices go to $5 because there's a shortage in the Middle East and say there's gouging here and that we want to take away market forces? So please tell me what is going to determine for the governor that there's an abnormal disruption that's not defined in this bill.
Chair Holvey, Representative Girard, in Section 5 of the bill, there actually is a definition of abnormal disruption of the market. It means any human created or natural event or circumstance that causes essential consumer goods or services to be not readily available. We've actually looked at this very provision in the context of the drastic price increases that occurred after the 2001 World Trade Center attacks. And those price increases were largely due to a misconception that there would be a shortage of gasoline prices, that there would be a problem with the market. They disappeared within 24 to 48 hours. There were violations of some general provisions of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, but I give you that as an example of something that probably wouldn't constitute an abnormal disruption of the market, even though we all remember the events of those days and what it did to the market prices in America.
But if you abnormal disruption of the market means any human created or natural event or circumstances that cause essential consumer goods or services to not be readily available, that's a pretty broad definition, and that's what burns in here, is that it just seems like anything could, if you're gouging, obviously, if prices are high or higher than what he thinks, then any of this could be true, and it just seems so broad that he could declare an emergency almost at will.
Chair Holvey, Representative Girard, I would agree with you that it is broad. It's broad to give some leeway to the governor, whoever that may be, at the time that this statute is needed. I would respectfully disagree that it's open to anything. Again, we saw price increases after 9/11 upwards of 30%. I don't believe this statute could have been instituted in the days after September 11, 2001. So there are confinements for the governor, but we did want to give the governor some leeway. I do understand your concerns. So.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Scholl, for being here. I have a question about the use of the words human created, and I see them in a couple of places, once in that section on page 3, but then again on page 4. Say, for example, someday the Olympics come to Oregon, and there's a shortage of rooms because the Olympics are coming. Is that a human-created situation in this bill?
Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, I don't believe so. The laundry list of how the statute defines human-created or natural event is fairly telling of the drastic, overwhelming events that would cause this. Organized, scheduled athletic events, I don't think could be contemplated under the statute.
Thank you. I just wanted a clarification because it says it includes but is not limited to. And can I ask a follow-up question?
Follow-up, please.
And then going back to page 3, where there's a definition of emergency that includes human-created or natural event. And I'm line 13 or 14. Can you please explain the situation contemplated with the language, a crisis influx of migrants unmanageable by a county?
Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, The short answer for that is no. The long answer is we could get that answer for you from Legislative Council. You'll notice that that's actually not something we've added. It's highlighted in bold because for some reason they moved it as opposed to just creating the new provision around it. So they in essence deleted it, then placed it down below. I can tell you, as I recall the way Legislative Council explained it to me, it doesn't involve possibly what those of us involved in Oregon today would think of as the crisis influx of immigrants. It had to do with a drought in southern Oregon and how people were shifting from northern California to southern Oregon, as I believe. Again, I can get you an actual reason for why that originally made it into the statute from Legislative Council.
I think it would be helpful to clarify what that is.
Absolutely, and it was explained to me at one time, so I know they've gone back and looked at it and figured out why it's there.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Nelson?
Thank you very much. Thank you for being here, Mr. Scholl. I don't see anything regarding health, and I'm thinking of things like bird flu, and is that covered under this? So the pharmaceutical companies couldn't charge us a lot for vaccines, or let's say we got mad cow disease. Is that
Chair Hovey,
covered under this?
Chair Hovey, Representative Nelson. Again, it would depend on whether it fell into the definitions, depending on what specific facts. But yes, something, an item like pharmaceuticals or drugs could be an essential consumer item under the proper facts.
Further questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, when you say, and we all were unified as a nation around 9/11, but when you say the kind of gouging we saw, do you mean what we observed in New York or something that we experienced in Oregon as well?
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, the short answer to that is it's something that was seen across the nation, including Oregon, and let me stress that they were allegations of price gouging, and they were investigated under general provisions of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. We didn't see, and ironically today it seems like a low number given what I paid for gas yesterday, but we didn't see the $6 plus per gallon increase that they saw in places in the Midwest after 9/11, but again, we did see increases within that first 24 and 48 hours that came close to 30% over what they had been sold for, you know, the previous day.
I have a follow-up if I may.
Follow-up.
Just to pursue that a little bit, what about Katrina's effect on Oregon prices? And I'd like a little more detail on the biscuit fire, because it seemed like it was the main sort of Oregon example that put you in.
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, the price increases that were seen in Oregon after Katrina were relatively, and again, relatively minor compared to what was seen in the Gulf Coast. And that difference was, as I understood the market, one, a lot of our oil comes from Alaska, is refined in Seattle and brought down to Oregon. And so we saw a price increase that was essentially based on sort of the overall market and the overall global prices of oil. And those were, as I understood it in the news, those were increased because of the lack of distribution occurring in the Gulf Coast, because so much of the industry had been shut down, at least temporarily. So that would be different than within the states like Mississippi itself, where it went through the roof more so than, say, the market or the global prices, simply because there wasn't very much of it left. On the biscuit fire, we threw that in there because it's simply one of the most recent for Oregon. as I remember the facts, lots of people are coming into the fire zone, whether it's media or other persons. And again, those wouldn't be for personal or family or household use. The issue may come up if those prices are being increased within that geographical area solely because they can be, and say the family needs to find a room, needs to find adequate housing because they've either been forced out of their house for evacuation purposes or because it's destroyed.
May I have one more follow-up, Mr.
Chair?
Follow-up,
please.
I don't know how you, I mean, sort out the complexity of why and how world oil prices go up, and I think that there is a relationship to disaster. But let's put that aside. That's a very complex issue. It seems to me that as important as it is that our folks aren't getting gouged in emergencies, two things. One, we don't have a long record of price gouging in Oregon. And secondly, it seems to me that the governor, even without this bill, during a crisis, has a number of tools at his disposal, and it feels like this is a whole lot of hammer for a problem that I'm not convinced exists.
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, I agree that it's a powerful tool. It's a powerful tool, in my opinion, because it needs to be. We don't hope it's ever needed, at least not on the scale of those states that suffered most under Hurricane Katrina. But we believe in those circumstances a powerful hammer is needed. On the history of price gouging in Oregon, I would point out that because it's not necessarily in the aftermath of statewide or even what somebody from Mississippi would now consider a massive disaster. But we have seen history of flooding and other events in certain communities, and there have been instances of price gouging. It's often an example that is often building materials and labor from outside sources, not Oregon businesses. But it has been there and it has occurred. I think what I would say is we consider ourselves lucky that we haven't faced something on the scale of Hurricane Katrina or the 2004 tsunamis in recent history.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you very much. I'm just curious, would it be appropriate to specify the exposure, i.e. Mount St. Helens? You know, maybe it only impacted half of our state. Southern Oregon wasn't impacted, but everybody gets the benefit of the governor jumping on any vendors.
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, the way the proposal is intended and the way we hope it's drafted is that the governor can only declare an abnormal disruption of the market for that geographical area that's affected by whatever has occurred. One of the examples on the Senate side was a severe or drastic winter storm in southern Oregon. He could limit it to certain counties and to a certain geographical area, not affecting the rest of Oregon.
Page
1990.
How about the lack of water in southern Oregon over the last 2 years down there? Would that be considered an emergency?
Chair Holvey, Representative Farmers. Nelson, it's absolutely, as I understand it, considered an emergency. One of the reasons that the statute and the proposal are drafted the way we'd like them to be drafted is industry brought up, rightfully so, that there was a concern with a declaration of emergency for a drought in southern Oregon essentially affecting price of lumber in southern Oregon. That's why it's couched in the terms of an abnormal disruption of market. It can be declared by the governor independently in conjunction with an declaration of emergency, state of emergency, but it cannot occur automatically when the governor declares a state of emergency. So the governor may declare a state of emergency due to drought in southern Oregon, but he may find no abnormal disruption of the market.
Okay, and last follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Mr. Shaw, what is my punishment if I'm a gas station owner or grocery store owner and I really push up the price of ice and water and basics?
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, this would become a part of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It's limited to Attorney General action and District Attorney action. There wouldn't be a private cause of action, but it is a part of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. So we are able, under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, to seek permanent injunctive relief or injunctive relief to stop the price increases, civil penalties of up to $25,000 per violation, and any other relief the court may deem appropriate. So the long answer to your question is it would depend on the facts. We see violations of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act that maybe only warrant requesting from the court a $1,000 civil penalty. We see others that warrant the maximum.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And just to clarify for my own mind, maybe I didn't hear you correctly the first time, but I think you clarified it. After Hurricane Katrina, you referenced some price gouging of gasoline along the golf course. Or was that?
My apologies, Chair Colby. That was Gulf Coast, and I did try to correct myself.
Oh, okay.
That would be it.
A nice day. That's what
I won't comment.
Sorry, I couldn't let you get away.
I won't comment on price gouging next to golf courses.
May I ask?
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I found another question as I'm going through. You had an attachment to your testimony about other states and what they're doing, and I noticed in, and I'm trying to read this quickly, but it, in the states where they do have a percentage above the price immediately charged, most of them that I found was 10%, but this bill has 15%, and I wonder how you arrived at the 15% rather than the 10%, which seems to be what other states who have a set amount.
Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, absolutely. A select few of the states that have put percentages have put 10%. I believe there's at least one that put 20%. And the other factor that we took into consideration was the majority of the states don't have a percentage. In order for it to work as an effective tool, we believe the states that have put a percentage in have the right idea. The 15% was sort of a compromise between everything that existed and everything that we've learned with industry and work groups in past sessions. I believe, in fact, that 10% had been selected at one time, and it was made clear to us that that was too low, even though other states do it.
This gives more flexibility to follow up. Thank you. And in the states that do have these anti-price gouging statutes, do you know how often they've been implemented in general?
Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, no. We know of the most recent and the ones that make the media, particularly the hurricanes that occur fairly regularly in Florida and elsewhere in the Gulf Coast. I can look into that number for you, but the short answer is no. I don't know how often it has been implemented by the various states.
Another question, Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Holden. I'd like to go back to Representative Bonamici asked about such things as the Olympic trials down in Eugene, and I know in one of our committees we're trying to get the Olympics into Portland. I don't understand why that isn't included in this bill, because if I read the bill, especially lines 6 through 10 on page 4, hotel rooms are included as part of the gouging thing that you're going to be looking at, and so and it's obviously a man-made sort of thing. So, you know, a room that might go for $100 might go for $1,000 during the Olympics. I know it's something that you say, well, I wouldn't want him to, why can't he? I guess is a better question.
Chair Holvey, Representative Gerard. Again, as Representative Bonamici pointed out, it's a including but not necessarily limited to. But what the laundry list includes concentrates on those events that we consider drastic and chaos and tragedy. So, again, I would stress that I don't believe that the statute contemplates a scheduled athletic event as something that a governor could declare an abnormal disruption of the market. You're absolutely correct that it does include hotel rooms, but again, I don't know if you get past that first hurdle of the declaration of the abnormal disruption of the market because of what the statute and what's contemplated by human created or natural event. I would stress that should a governor declare an abnormal disruption of the market, that does not sit well with the Legislative Assembly. The Legislative Assembly has the power to remove it.
Thank you. And just a follow-up question on that laundry list. Where would you put, say, a war, for example? I'm thinking back into the 70s when the price of gas just really got high and we couldn't find gas in the state of Oregon. And
that's right.
Was it related to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait or something to that effect? Would that fall into this definition?
Chair Holby, the answer to that is it very well could. Again, going back to the World Trade Center attacks in 2001, the statute doesn't necessarily contemplate something that has to occur in Oregon. Just like with the 2001 World Trade Center attacks, however, the chances of that being connected in a way to the Oregon, the lack of that essential consumer good in Oregon, I would think is highly unlikely. And just like with the World Trade Center attacks, it probably wouldn't fall under the statute. You probably couldn't declare an abnormal disruption of the market. But the statute absolutely does not require that the event has to occur in Oregon.
Mr. Chair. Okay, thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I'm listening to this and reading the bill, and it comes to mind that it's no matter how long the list is of the things that would or would not be included, it seems to me it's impossible to completely define the list because as soon as you do that, there's going to be something happen that we didn't anticipate. I understand the concern about the governor being able to do something that you know, we're not controlling, but I think this is a good bill. We don't want price gouging. I don't think anybody on this panel wants price gouging. And I see it as very difficult to define this. And I think you've done it. Whoever wrote this has done a fairly good job of the laundry list. War happens to be included in the laundry list. And Olympics aren't. So I think this is good. And I think I'm going to be supporting this. Thank you.
And Chair Holby, if I may, there are aspects of it that are necessarily broader than some may like. But with that being said, over many sessions, this concept has been narrowed and narrowed because we do understand the concerns with it. We do understand the problems with statutes that are simply too broad, and we've tried to reach a happy medium here.
Thank you. Further questions, Representative Galizio?
One comment, and then I have a question. The comment would be, I think there would be quite a bit of pressure on any governor, and any governor would think very carefully prior to doing this. So I would hope. But having said that, my question is, because
unless he owns a water company or something.
Yeah, that's right. So my question is, somebody, you know, the question about, it does specify acts of terrorism or war. So my question is not a could. I'm not asking about would the current governor do this, but could if this passed, let's say this passed tomorrow and was signed into law, because it specifically mentions acts of terrorism or war, would this allow a governor to point to current what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan and say gas prices are exorbitantly high and it constitutes taking unconscionable advantage of consumers?
Chair Halvey, Representative Galizio, again, going back to abnormal disruption of the market means any human created or natural event or circumstance that causes essential consumer goods or services to be not readily available would be what would be concentrated on there. So the short answer would be no. Despite the fact I didn't like what I paid for gas yesterday, my gas station had lots of it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Appreciate your testimony. Looks like you raised some questions on this particular bill, and I think committee's chewing on it. So
thank you very much,
that.
Committee members. And hopefully we don't run out of gas on golf courses. So. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 118 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 122. Is that the right number? Mm-hmm. Steve, can you give us a little summary of Senate Bill 122, please?
Thank you, Chair Holby. Senate Bill 122A specifies as unlawful trade practice mailing or causing to be sent a check, draft, or other payment instrument that, when deposited or cashed, creates a payment obligation for the depositor or payee.
Thank you. And with that, we'll have Mr. Scholl back in the hot seat.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Andrew Scholl with the Oregon Department of Justice Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. Senate Bill 122A is a live check proposal. Senate Bill 122 was amended with consensus amendments by the Senate Commerce Committee to address a concern voiced by an interested party. The resulting Senate Bill 122A passed the Senate on March 5th with 27 ayes and 3 excused. Since the Senate vote, however, another concern, this one regarding an existing judgment, has been brought to the attention of the Oregon Department of Justice by additional interested parties. Unfortunately, the solution presented by the additional parties is not something that's currently acceptable to the Attorney General, because it would create a disclosure requirement bill as opposed to the prohibition that's currently proposed. And let me explain. There are businesses that send consumers and other potential customers a cashable check, usually for a minor monetary amount like $3.50, which provides in fine print on the back of the check that cashing the check will obligate the individual or entity cashing the check to future payments for various forms of consideration. This can be future payments for a telephone listing or advertising for an entity on an internet site. It may include other various internet hookup services. In short, it can be for a number of services and merchandise in the future. Unfortunately, live checks are often packaged and sent in a manner that causes a likelihood of misunderstanding or confusion. They often cause individual consumers or entities cashing the check to believe that the check is a refund, a rebate, a payment of some nature other than by the means of the person or the entity accepting an offer. Under existing law, live check business models have been investigated pursuant to both the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act and the Oregon Civil Racketeering Influence and Corrupt Organization Act. The results have been prosecutions and settlements under both. Many of these have been multi-state actions. A multi-state in general terms is where several attorneys general coordinate on investigating violations of law. They may coordinate on filing lawsuits in each of their respective jurisdictions, or they may coordinate on negotiating acceptable settlements. Well, at least one of these multi-state actions recently resulted in the use of live or activation checks continuing under certain circumstances. The most recent action was a coordinated multi-state investigation involving 34 states' attorneys general that resulted in a settlement agreement which wholly prohibited the use of the live or activation checks by the business in the 34 states. The differences in results in enforcement actions typically depends upon reasonably achievable protections for consumers, which are at least superior to the status quo of protections for consumers existing prior to a given enforcement action in the context of litigation negotiations. Senate Bill 122A is needed because live or activation checks have a propensity to be inherently deceptive regardless of the level of disclosures provided with the checks. This is largely due to the fact that only a finite amount of information can be placed upon a check. However, were substantial amounts of information specifically regarding the ramifications of cashing these checks to be provided upon and concurrent with the checks themselves would continue to have a propensity to be inherently deceptive because they're checks. They're not contracts. They're not applications. They're just checks. Further, even where we see separate information accompany these checks, there's still a substantial risk of confusion since the information tends to be formatted or viewed by the consumer as an advertisement insert or similar envelope stuffer. In one past federal action, the Federal Trade Commission versus cyberspace.com, it was shown to the court that less than 1% of those cashing checks that purportedly authorized subsequent payment for Internet service ever actually logged on to the service that they authorized to pay for. Senate Bill 122A prohibits the mailing or delivering of a check that, when cashed, acts as authorization by the person or entity cashing the check to make any payment that is not an extension of credit or an offer to lend money. The legislation doesn't prohibit the mailing or delivering of what we call incentive checks, that is where separate authorization is enclosed with the check. For example, a check enclosed with a contract to be signed by the person or entity cashing the check, or with some other form of sign-up authorization is required or authorized or otherwise received. Senate Bill 122A does make the sending or delivering of affected live checks a specific violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And with that, I will again attempt to answer any questions you may have. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Representative Riley.
That was a long, very legal explanation. And let me see if I understand what you said in plain language. If I get a check in the mail and it says on it, signing this, by cashing this check, you agree to pay for a subscription to the magazine or whatever, something like that, that will no longer be legal under this bill.
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, correct. That would be one of the merchandise options.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
So if I get a check like that and I cash it, I'm not obligated to anything. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, we would like it that way, correct, under Senate
Bill
122A.
Okay.
And Governor Gerard.
One more. That's a good reason. Please. Last one. I used to hear that if I, instead of signing them, I said for deposit only, that took care of the problem.
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, restrictive endorsements such as that are covered under other Oregon law and would not necessarily be a part of this proposal. I'd also like to stress, if I may, Chair Holvey, that on your subscription, one of the examples that wouldn't be prohibited, one of the incentive checks, is what's known as a check voucher. And it's essentially a check that you would still get the $5.50. You would send that to the magazine company with your authorization, and that $5.50 would be credited to your first payment for your subscription.
But that's not a check you can take to the bank.
Correct. On the check you can take to the bank, they would still be allowed to use incentive checks where you still get the $5.50, you can cash the check, but to sign up for the magazine subscription, something more, whatever that more may be, would need to be required.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question, just a comment about why I support this bill. These things are typically used with people like senior citizens who don't understand that by signing the check, they're obligating themselves to a service. Therefore, it's a type of marketing that does not need to be used. If somebody wants to sell something to somebody, they should be up front with it. It's kind of a sneaky way of trying to get somebody to buy something. So I support this bill.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schell, I'll say that although there have been times in my life that these are the only checks that have actually come in the mail to me, I will be supporting this bill.
Representative Nelson.
I'd just like to say if Representative Gilliam would change his character, he might get a few more, like I get a lot of them. Mr. Schell. This is really interesting, and you know, every time I get one of these, I just get furious. And what's even worse are those, and especially makes me upset when I get ones that send me a dollar bill, you know, they glue the quarters to a card. You know, I mean, this, I just always take them off, put them back in the envelope, and send them back to the people. But, you know, it seems such a crazy thing to do. But one of the biggest ones are those sweepstakes things. Does this qualify under here? Because they say, you know, you may not get cash, but you may get gifts. Is that covered here?
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson.
Congratulations, you've won, you know.
I kind of know what you're talking about. I don't know. We would have to look into it because the charity sweepstakes that I've seen are sort of a different beast. But I do understand. I think I understand what it is that you're contemplating, and maybe we should talk afterwards.
Okay, thank you. And a follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Well, what I'm curious about is the probably 99% of these that I get from all over the country are from somewhere else. So how are we going to discipline them? I mean, what do? Every time I get one, I report it to your office and say, this creepy, crummy company is sending me these creepy, crummy checks.
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, essentially that, yes. And the complaint would work its way through our process. But the end result of that may be that it, in fact, is a company that's based and wholly operating out of, say, Florida.
Delaware.
No. Or Delaware. And the location of the company wouldn't matter. It would matter that they've availed themselves and they're doing business in Oregon.
So, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Could I just find out what do we have, a trial? Do we have a... What do we do to...
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, sorry, I misunderstood your question. Absolutely. Just as with anything else under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, if there's a pattern, if it's egregious conduct, we would institute an investigation, and depending on how that happens, many times there's settlements, there are trials, there are stipulated judgments. However you would resolve it, then you would use that Unlawful Trade Practices Act and the mechanisms in there to enforce the law against that company, despite the fact that they're not an Oregon company.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Gilliam.
Just to comment, Mr. Chair, I probably, if this makes it to the floor, I'll have to declare conflict of interest. My Uncle Vinny is a major shareholder in the creepy, crummy company.
I meant creeper. I didn't. Sorry.
With that, seeing no further questions, I really appreciate your testimony. Thank you much for bringing
thank
it
you.
Forward. Next up, I'd like to have Greg, I apologize, Peden, and Mike Dewey.
I'm not sure I want to be with Mr. Freaky here.
I didn't know that. I didn't know his name was Vinny. So, for clarity, and to meet all our standards. Please identify yourself for the record.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Greg Peden. I'm a lobbyist with the Gallatin Group. I'm here today representing a corporation called Trilogent. Trilogent is a marketing firm, does marketing, as we've discussed here, across the country. The concern that my client has with this bill, and is encapsulated somewhat in the testimony that the AG's office provided, is that last fall, my client negotiated a permanent consent decree with the Attorney General's office here in Oregon about how to conduct its business going forward, signed by the parties and entered into the record in Marion County, stipulating very specifically how to conduct such marketing activities in Oregon. At the same time, the AG's office filed this bill, pre-session filed this bill to eliminate this activity altogether. I've been hired subsequent to that since the bill's passed the committee because my client wasn't even aware the bill was being heard, and they have some heartburn over that and have some concerns, and that's the large reason that we're here before you. The AG did mention that we submitted some language to him to modify the bill that would add some strengthening of the disclosure language located at the site on a check where you would authorize the check or sign the check that would clearly indicate that this was committing the signer to future agreements. The other thing that I don't see in the bill and that I'm unclear of from the AG's testimony is the statement that the bill doesn't prohibit the mailing or delivery of incentive checks where separate authorization is enclosed. I don't see that language in the bill, and I'm surprised to hear that today and would like the opportunity, I suppose, to further understand from the AG what that means and where that where there might be some opportunity to work there. That's my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dewey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Dewey. I represent DeHart & Dar. It's a company on the East Coast that represents direct marketing companies. And to Representative Nelson with the Attorney General, a number of years ago, we worked on sweepstakes in terms of making sure that the information was not misleading. And I'll give you a story prior to doing that. My son was in junior high at the time, middle school, and he called me at the office and said, "We won $1 million or something like that." And I said, what are you talking about? He said, "Well, we've got the sweepstakes," and I read through it, and we won $1 million. And I said, "Well, read through it." He was a good reader. And I said, "Read through it again and tell me, you know, where it says we really didn't win $1 million. We might be eligible, but we didn't really win $1 million. And he couldn't find it, and it was 6 pages of, if you will, prose. And I finally, about after half an hour, I found the paragraph, and we fixed those kinds of things. And I say that because the company that I represent, representing direct marketing companies, we all have First Amendment rights. From time to time, we don't like getting certain mail that we receive. I know Representative Gilliam was happy to see those checks come his way, and I appreciate that.
He's got one.
but the point is, we may not like it. We have proffered up an amendment that goes further than what Mr. Peden talked about. I received that late, was it 5:33, and Legislative Council was not available. So I have an amendment that speaks to the disclosure requirements, speaks to making it clear that, let's say you're joining a club by signing and endorsing the check, speaks to how you can cancel and what the process is. It speaks to, if you use a credit card, what the protocol is, a debit card, and the like. Now, I will say for the record, as far as I know, the member companies with the Direct Marketing Association, through my client, represents nobody is doing this, but we always look for an opportunity to make sure that there is the right kind of disclosure. And therefore, people can make the decision as to whether or not they want to endorse the check and hopefully, not always, but hopefully know what they're buying. And so we haven't had an opportunity because we haven't seen the amendments come out of LC at this point in time. I would get those to the Attorney General's office as quickly as possible. And I'm also interested in the contractual part of the discussion because, as Mr. Peden said, I didn't see that either. I will close with this. Hopefully it doesn't offend you. We have individuals that are trying to get somebody to open up the mail. And it ought not to be misleading, but you want somebody to read it. I mean, that's what it's all about. And when you're running your campaigns, it's the same thing. You want to not misleading anybody, but you want to make sure people read it. And that's the situation which these companies are trying to do. Now, if they are misleading, if they're not following the statute, then they ought to be under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And they ought to be hit real hard. And we don't have any problems with that whatsoever. So with that, we have some amendments. This is a public hearing. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And I understand that because there is some concern about these kinds of activities. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dewey, I hope you weren't suggesting that we send out a check in our campaign literature.
You cannot do that. I know that. So,
both of you represent companies that do business nationally. Is that correct?
Yes.
And are your companies operating in other states that prohibit live checks?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is a trend that I understand is occurring in terms of legislation. I do know that there was legislation that was in California which is not moving. But that isn't to say that there are other states that have adopted this. And I can find out, and I assume the AG has the same information, but I'm very happy to find out what the situation is. But I do know that there was a bill that was offered in California. And I think in part, what we're saying is just some practices. And his client signed a voluntary consent decree and those kinds of things that you do from time to time. Therefore, you have a piece of legislation.
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative Bonamici, we signed a consent decree similar to Oregon. I believe 17 other states and are operating under those consent decrees in other states as well, but I'm not aware of where there's a permanent elimination of these type of marketing activities. DHG may know that answer, but I don't.
Thank you.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You were talking about, finding in the bill where something is allowed, and usually you don't find something that's allowed in a bill. You only find those things that are not allowed. I guess I have no problem with the incentive check as long as I have to sign a contract and send it back to you as well. I have a huge problem with assuming that I'm agreeing to something without me signing a contract, and I think that's what these do. So I have a huge problem with this area. So.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, I believe, depending on how the amendments come out, we'll see some of that. It may not go far enough for you, but it's with regard to the information that you provide. And you're going to provide it. You agree if it's on the credit card, for example. So it goes further than just signing the check. But I haven't seen the form and style yet of these amendments, and I think we'll see them fairly soon.
We're not talking about credit cards in this bill.
Well, if I may, I mean, it's you will. There are some, as I understand it, some incentives that get your, somehow they get your, you provide credit card information, and I'm just saying that if that is the case, then you need to go further in terms of the information that you provide.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions?
One more.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What do your, the companies that you represent, what is it that they market? What are they selling?
Well, as I noted in the phone call I had this morning about this piece of legislation, the companies that my client represents are not in, they're not doing this, but again, they're looking at every opportunity to talk about disclosure and what ought to be in the disclosure. So if we think about direct marketing companies, they are in the sweepstakes business, for example, the Reader Digest types of examples. Quite frankly, they're in the, interestingly or not, you this committee, not this committee, but one of the health committees passed a bill on the school lunch program. And then the question is fundraisers, you know, outside of that particular piece of legislation. So they're involved in Girl Scouts and Boy Scout fundraisers and the like, and maybe a magazine drive, those kinds of things. So really, Mr. Chair and Representative, it's really all over the board with regard to a company that that Greg represents.
I think that's accurate.
Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions? Not seeing any at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for your testimony. And did the committee wish to ask any further questions of the Department of Justice that pops into their mind about incentive checks or anything?
If they have the answer to the question about other states, I'd like to know that.
We'll get it for you.
Thank you.
Okay.
I just want to say one thing if I could. Good Chair. You know, back to the sweepstakes thing, there are many, many times, it could be timeshare on a hotel in Vegas or whatever, you receive a document. Maybe it's not a check, but it is a
voucher.
Yeah, voucher is the word for whatever it is they're, you know, going to allow you to do. And then you get there, and of course it's not. It's, you know, the hotel rooms are, you know, $100 more than you anticipated. But I'm just saying there's just all sorts of sweepstake things. You know, if you sign this voucher, you have won one of these three items, you know, color TV, you know, new Cadillac, or a trip to around the world.
Do you care to add a comment, Mr. Schulte? Could you introduce yourself again for the record, please?
Again, for the record, Andrew Schulte, Assistant Attorney General, Oregon Department of Justice. Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, I know what you're talking about. Again, I think it was Representative Gilliam or Representative Riley that indicated that that's not a check that you take to the bank and cash it, so it's a little bit different. Representative Riley, I'm seeing, is the one who indicated that. But Representative Nelson, that doesn't mean that it wouldn't be a misrepresentation or some other possible violation under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It just may not be covered by the statute. And Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, we will find the answer for you on the other states.
And can I ask one more question since Mr. Schulte walked back up here?
Absolutely.
Could you please clarify the incentive check issue, because there's some confusion about whether or not that those incentive checks would be prohibited under this bill?
Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, absolutely. The proposal contemplates a check that is the contract in and of itself. It is the offer, signing it and cashing it. It is the acceptance, even though, again, our experience with these would show that there simply isn't any meeting of the minds in terms of most consumers that cash these checks. The incentive check is a check where you send it, and then the authorization is through something separate. So the business runs the risk of losing that $3.50, meaning they may cash the incentive check and they may not fulfill the other requirement to purchase their service. But it's still a check, and it's still something that's sent to the consumer as just that, an incentive to get them to sign this agreement. It just doesn't act as the contract, the offer, the agreement, the acceptance in and of itself.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today on that. With anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 122A? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 122A And I'm going to carry over the work session on Senate Bill 122A and Senate Bill 118A to Wednesday. Thank you very much, committee, for your diligent work. The House Committee on Consumer Protection stands adjourned.